This week, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers celebrates its 130th anniversary. And as we have done each year since the Henry Miller Museum opened in 2016, we commemorate the occasion by sharing a bit of our early history and thanking some of those good brothers and sisters whose personal contributions not only helped save the home, but continue to help maintain it. On this year's episode, we review Henry's first AFL convention as a delegate after our formation and recognize everyone's favorite volunteer tour guide, Brother Dave Roth, Financial Secretary of IBW Local 1 in St. Louis. A large portion of the images of our visiting brothers and sisters shared through the museum's social media channels were taken by Dave. He also spends a great deal of time ensuring our museum stays in tip-top shape. Now, if you'd like to join one of Dave's tours, we ask that you provide as much advance notice as possible by calling the main office between 7 and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at 314-647-5900. There's nothing more gratifying for us than to see this incredible tribute to the American trade union movement put to good use. Now, if you listen to our 129th anniversary episode, you may remember our interview with Ben Blake, archivist at the George Meany Archives in Maryland, noting the historic records from the early AFL conventions are sparse at best. The AFL chronicled their conventions through printed proceedings, and most of those proceedings are readily available through a simple Google search. All the historic references for this year's episode will be available for download in the show notes. Now, joining us this year with expert commentary is University of Maryland Professor of History Kyle Pruitt. Professor Pruitt is a labor historian, a member of LAWCHA, the Labor and Working Class History Association, and for a time, during his undergrad work, was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. So he's a true trade unionist, and we really, really enjoyed talking to him about labor history and the current state of the American trade union movement. Now, as noted in Article 3 of the proceedings, the AFL conventions were held annually. And this is the thing about these convention proceedings. They included several pieces of the original AFL Constitution from the turn of the century. So in Article 3 states, the AFL conventions were held annually commencing at 10 a.m. on the second Monday in December. And Henry's first convention as a delegate would be the 11th for the AFL, even though officially the AFL at that time was only 5 years old. They continued to tally their conventions from the formation date of the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Union, the FOTLU, which was formed in Philly in November of 1881. The reorganization of the FOTLU into the AFL was a response by the craft unions to some of the actions that were taken by the Knights of Labor, actions that would eventually lead to their ultimate demise. Now, those events, if you're interested, are summarized in a historic document from the 50th anniversary of the St. Louis Labor Council. That document will also be linked for download in the show notes. Most of us recognize November 28th as our anniversary date, the last day of our inaugural convention. And as the story goes, our founders immediately applied for a charter. And that is where our story begins. The convention roster on page 7 of the proceedings lists Henry as a delegate from the Electrical Wiremen and Linemen's Union, number 5221. Why is he not listed as a delegate from the National Brotherhood? The Birmingham News reports, "The Committee on Credentials here presented an unfavorable report on the credentials of Henry Miller of the National Electrical Workers Union, on the ground that financially the organization was not in good standing and had not been affiliated with the American Federation the length of time required by its constitution." So there you go. Now, that's from the Birmingham News. And this requirement is spelled out in the proceedings. These are excerpts from the AFL's constitution. "In order to be represented at the convention by a delegate, an organization had to be in existence at least 1 month prior to the start of the convention. When Henry arrives in Birmingham for his first AFL convention, we are only 10 days old. There's a second requirement, and that's a per capita contribution. There just was not enough time for us to comply with that, and there's no way our founder was going to wait an additional year and skip the convention." Be that as it may, it does not prevent the president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, from formally recognizing our formation in his opening address. Page 12 of the convention, just a couple of lines, states, "The electrical workers were organized into a national union from the various local unions affiliated to the Federation." And you see this leading up to this convention, And then after the convention, there's this push by Gompers urging the other affiliates to help the electrical workers organize their trade. In 1892, Henry again returns as a delegate to the 12th AFL convention, but this time his credentials are reported on favorably. He's recorded in the official proceedings, and the roster lists him as representing the National Brotherhood of Electrical Workers of America. Now, the newspapers also document Henry's successful effort to organize a local in Birmingham, Alabama. While he's traveling to Birmingham, he's also organizing local unions on the way. Our founder remains steadfast in his commitment to building our union, even while attending to his formal duties as our first grand president. Here now with more on that is Professor Pruitt.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I read these autobiographies of, you know, prominent organizers back in the 1870s, 1880s. They never stayed in the same town for more than a week. They probably, you know, traveling 30, 40,000 miles in 10 days. It's just absurd, you know. They would go on the tramp and, you know, ride on the rails or just, you know, just walk hundreds of miles town to town organizing locals, like, tirelessly. Really impressive. And, you know, even the AFL, going back to the 1880s, 1890s, it's like a lot of their national leadership, they come right out of the rank and file. They were and still were, you know, hoofing it as organizers at the time they were doing work for the national organization, you know, in Washington, D.C. You know, it's not until later that you get the rise of, like, you know, professional labor bureaucrats in some of the unions.
Now, to best tell the rest of this story, you need to understand what is happening with the American Federation of Labor during this period.
Gompers and the other leaders like Adolf Strasser and McGuire in the AFL are really having trouble kind of consolidating their control over the national organization because dozens of local organizations, you know, local labor councils, like the one in New York, St. Louis, or even state federations of labor, do have voting power and representation within the AFL. So there is conflict between Gompers and the socialists from the Central Labor Union in New York and other labor unions, like the one in Chicago, for example. So there's some real conflict there. And I'm wondering, you know, Miller is German from St. Louis, and, you know, socialism outside of New York is probably nowhere stronger than St. Louis, maybe Chicago.
We asked Professor Pruitt why Samuel Gompers refused to allow the Socialist Labor Party to affiliate with the American Federation of Labor.
It might not be for the reason you expect. Gompers, when he was younger in the 70s and 80s, the 1870s and 1880s, he was a Marxist. He taught himself German to read Marx. So he became a socialist of sorts, but he was opposed to another type of socialism in the United States that saw the way forward for workers was through an organization of their own political party. And for Gompers and others like him, the way forward for workers was through trade unionism and not a political party, right? So the debate was not necessarily like over whether or not socialism is good. The debate is over, you know, strategy. And for Gompers, he really does not want members in the convention who are going to what Gompers says, enslave workers to any one political party, whether or not it's the Socialist Labor Party, the Democrats, or the Republican Party. Right. So for him, trade unions have to be like the ultimate expression of working class organization, not political parties. I hope that makes sense. It's a little bit weird, right? Because these are debates I don't really see in today's labor movement that much.
For me, the real legacy of Samuel Gompers is that he was able to hold this coalition together, given all these competing interests.
Gompers, I think, is really an incredible individual. Not only, you know, as an organizer, but like as an administrator, I've spent, you know, hours in his correspondence going through day by day, letter by letter at the turn of the 20th century. And he is in communication with virtually every local and every state federation and every national trade union in the country constantly. You know, not necessarily coordinating strikes or strike funds or things like that or boycotts, but always making sure there's some type of national cooperation between the national trade unions. And especially to kind of really direct their support at key moments for things like, you know, the 8-hour day or the passage of an anti-injunction law, which, you know, injunctions were being used by the courts to crush strikes, tens of thousands of strikes in this period. So Gomper is this amazing political mobilizer. You know, we often see him as just kind of a pure and simple trade unionist guy, but like he has a very sophisticated understanding of politics and how laborers can kind of pressure politicians to, you know, pass certain policies that they wanted at the time. So, you know, there are many aspects to him, but the guy was really tireless and he was a really effective administrator, I'd say.
So during the afternoon on the fifth day of the convention, Henry finds himself in the middle of this ongoing battle between the trade unionists and the Socialist Labor Party within the AFL. And I think maybe the best way to tell this story is just to read it verbatim from a historic newspaper as they relate it. Now, this comes from the Birmingham News after the convention, December 19th, 1891, and it deals directly with the re-election of Samuel Gompers. It says, President Gompers stopped the report of the Committee on Laws, saying that a special order was set for that hour, 5 o'clock, for the election of officers. He then called Delegate Furuseth of San Francisco to the chair. Mr. Furuseth said that being unexperienced in the parliamentary lore, he begged to be excused, but President Gompers promptly replied that when a true union man was assigned a duty, it should be his pleasure to discharge the same. Mr. Furuseth urged no further objection. I'm sorry, this is verbatim. And accepted the vacant chair and called for nominations for president. Now, buckle up. The next four lines. Delegate Miller of the Electrical Workers arose and in a few eloquent words presented the name of Mr. August Delabar of New York. Mr. Delabar declined. The proceedings tell it a little bit differently. So there were two delegates from St. Louis with the last name of Miller. There was Owen Miller from the Musicians Union of St. Louis, and there was Henry from the National Brotherhood. For me personally, I think probably the Birmingham News is correct, and I'll tell you why. If you continue to read the proceedings, the votes, when the votes are cast, Owen Miller votes for Gompers, Henry votes for Delabar. Now, Delabar has declined the nomination, but Henry votes for him anyway. We asked Professor Pruitt for his educated opinion on why that may have been.
I'm going to venture a guess. I can't find any evidence for this, for why Miller would oppose Gompers. But Gompers in 91 takes a stand against European immigration. And I have found, you know, in my research that German socialists and trade unionists in St. Louis in particular really hated that. They militated against him, against Gompers, you know, really strong in the 1890s and opposed the AFL supporting immigration restriction. Now, Miller supports Delabar, and Delabar is from the bakery workers, right? And the bakers and the brewers are the other major national trade unions who oppose the AFL supporting immigration restriction. So that could be a point of conflict between Gompers and Miller and the rest of the, you know, the socialists in the AFL. That's my guess.
Now, we don't want to leave you with this impression that Gompers just opposed immigration outright. What he opposed was the exploitation of immigrants by capitalists. Here again is Professor Pruitt.
No, I think that's exactly correct. And, you know, Gompers makes a note, you know, that we don't want to be know-nothings, which is referring to the anti-Catholic, anti-Irish party of the 1840s. He's saying, you know, we're not opposed to unfair immigration because we dislike foreigners for being foreign. We're just arguing that immigration is coming into the United States, it's such a volume that it's undermining our ability to organize and win a higher standard of living. So Gompers and others argue that, you know, we have to organize everyone who is in the United States, whether, you know, whether they're an immigrant or they're native born. Gompers actually pressures President Wilson to open up a labor union information bureau at Ellis Island during World War One to help channel immigrant workers arriving on Ellis Island into the labor movement. Right. So I think your summary is exactly right. Like, they see immigration as like a key factor in their fight with capitalists and their fight to, you know, build stronger labor unions, win our 8-hour day laws and things like that in the United States. So for them, it's a matter of like their conflict with capitalists, I think.
Henry's vote against Samuel Gompers would be an anomaly. When he returns as a delegate the following year, he votes for Gompers. And throughout all the challenges faced by the AFL president at that time, he never once stops urging other AFL affiliates to assist Henry and our founding fathers in organizing electrical workers in the United States. There are other notable aspects of Henry's first convention that highlight the character of our forefathers in the labor movement. Recorded in the proceedings is a formal communication from President Gompers and AFL Secretary Chris Evans urging the U.S. House and Senate to grant women the right to vote through a constitutional amendment. Here's Professor Pruitt.
You know, it often gets overlooked when people talk about the trade union movement of the late 19th century. So, like, a lot of focus is put on how these trade unions were male dominated. And, you know, in many ways, that was true. But I think trade unionists recognized that the working class in the United States was becoming increasingly feminine over time, that there were just more and more women workers in, you know, virtually every industry. And I think that really, that comes down in that endorsement of the right to vote for women, which, you know, the AFL supports year after year in convention. And there's really never any debate surrounding that. It's kind of taken for granted among the AFL that it's going to support, you know, expanding the vote to women.
So happy birthday, IBW, and thank you, Professor Pruitt, for jumping on the line and sharing your knowledge with us. And thanks to our good friend Dave Roth for his great work to sustain the museum. If you want to come by and visit the museum, we'd love to have you. It's your museum. We've had several local unions from the 11th and 6th District that have come to the museum to host executive board meetings, retiree parties, organizing training. Plan a trip. Let's do it. It's a great venue. It's a spectacular testament to the American trade union movement. Thank you, brothers and sisters. Have a wonderful and safe holiday season.